Welcome to another episode of Pearls of Passage. I'm your host, Ellie Atherton. This is the eighth episode, and I feel like we're starting to get into a groove. I'm learning what listeners enjoy and trying to offer more of that content each week. I'm thrilled with the positive feedback I'm receiving and so happy the discussions are inspiring people to tune in week after week. I want to thank everyone in the U.S. and Canada who've been listening. I even have some listeners from across the pond too, so I want to say thank you to those in the U.K., Ireland, and Germany for tuning in as well. I've received some feedback via emails, phone calls, texts, and on the podcast comments this week. If you want to join the conversation, leave your comment using the comment button just above the episode on my website, and I'll respond. Forgiveness is an emotional topic for most people. Still, everyone seems to be relating to the stories that they're hearing. I think we're unaware of how deeply we're affected by not forgiving ourselves or not forgiving others until we hear a story we can relate to. Often, people recognize that although they feel content with life, their deep happiness and joy seems to be missing. I think this is due in part to forgiveness. Over the coming months, I'll touch on this subject frequently, but won't be focusing on it every week. I'll reveal some of the ways in which you can start on the path to forgiveness. This is one of the questions I received and a suggested topic for a future episode. I can tell you now, awareness is where it begins. I believe hearing other people's stories is one of the best ways to help us become aware and relate to issues around forgiveness. And once we can relate, then we're able to apply what we're learning and start to uncover the barriers to our own inability to forgive ourselves and others. This week, I don't have an interview to share. Instead, I've decided that I'm going to read a story from my first book, Stepping Stones. It's a story about forgiveness and a patient's inability to move past a difficult situation in her life, one that was holding her in fear. It's a short and pretty sweet story, and I hope you'll enjoy listening. Next week, I'll return with a one-on-one interview. So let me just give you a little detail about the story before I begin reading. I met the patient in the first months as a brand new hospice nurse in training back in 2003. It was the end of the summer, and my colleague was about to go on vacation. So I was assigned to visit the patient for her while she was away. This woman was a little rough around the edges, not a super emotional person, and so I would say prior to where the story begins, we hadn't made a close or a strong connection yet. Okay, I think that's enough detail to give you to get us started. So get yourself a cup of coffee or tea, put your feet up, get comfy, and enjoy the story. Here's Packing for the Journey. I met Helen quite a few times during my hospice training, when I shadowed a longtime hospice nurse colleague. Helen was a little spitfire, all of maybe 4'6" tall when she stood up straight, which she rarely did because leaning forward helped her to breathe more easily. She was a widow who lived alone in a quaint one-bedroom apartment in the country. It had everything she needed, a galley kitchen, an open concept dining living room area, and a small bedroom. The close proximity of the rooms was a gift because any movement caused Helen to experience labored breathing, even with her continuous use of oxygen. Helen had no children and no local family to act as caregivers when the need arose. She did have a sweet neighbor who lived directly across the hall from her. Claire had been checking on Helen for years and helped her by delivering groceries and attending medical visits. As Helen declined, Claire began checking on her each morning and evening. Over the summer months, when my colleague had time off, I would be the one to make the visits on my own. I grew to love this independent woman. I always told her she was as cute as a button. She would smile, laugh, and shake her hand at me. "Never mind," she would say. I sensed that she appreciated the compliment, but felt uncomfortable accepting it. This reaction seemed right in line with her tough exterior. I wasn't buying it, though. There was sweetness underneath her well-polished armor. One day, just as I was leaving, Helen asked if she could give me something. Her late husband had collected butterflies, and she said she wanted me to have one of the preserved and delicately framed insects as a remembrance of her. Since we had only met a few times, this gesture took me by surprise. Her thoughtfulness touched me deeply. On more than one occasion in my life, I had experienced a butterfly landing on my hand, allowing me to admire it for a few moments before it flew off again. I had a heart for the stunning winged creatures. I gratefully accepted Helen's gift of kindness, admiring the colorful wings of the butterfly she had chosen for me. I gave her a hug and thanked her for the generous and meaningful gift. I was elated by her kindness. It represented her trust and acceptance of me. As our relationship grew, I worried about who would care for Helen when she was too weak to care for herself. At weekly meetings of the hospice team, we often talked about what would happen to Helen. We hadn't determined who would stay with her in those final days. Of course, we had no way of knowing how long she would be bedbound and need assistance. This variable made it challenging to find caregivers who were able to commit to an open-ended role. These questions regarding her care remained unanswered because Helen didn't want to discuss them during our visits, always waving them off and changing the subject. Her reaction made it even more difficult for hospice staff to help her formulate a realistic plan. She kept saying she would figure it out. I worried about how Helen would manage to medicate herself if she was having trouble breathing and was too weak to get to her medication. I also worried about her falling in her weakened state and breaking a hip. That scenario usually ended in a hospital or nursing home death, and I knew that would surely add to her baseline anxiety level. It was sad to think that Helen might be alone at the end of her life. When the hospice staff embarked on conversations around her care, they did evoke emotion in Helen. On several occasions, she told me that she was annoyed with God. "He's making me wait too long. I've been ready to die for such a long time, and I've prayed and prayed for God to take me. I can't understand why he hasn't yet." I stayed silent as she vented her anger at God, and I had to wonder what was holding her intrepid spirit back. The next time my colleague went on vacation, I was assigned to visit Helen. I decided that if she started the same conversation, I was going to ask her what she thought might be stopping her from getting her wish to die. On that afternoon, after I had finished her assessment, she asked me again why God was taking so long. "I don't have the answer to that. I think you probably do, though," I responded as I had planned. "What do you mean by that answer?" Helen was clearly perturbed with me. "I would have died months ago if I knew," she said, exasperated. "Well, let's talk about this. Are you worried about anything? Is there something you're afraid of?" I asked her as I stared back at the dagger she was throwing me. She became defensive. "Do you mean, am I afraid of dying?" "Yes, that's precisely what I mean," I said. "Well, I do worry about gasping for breath at the end of my life," she admitted, letting some of the anger fall away as the truth tumbled out. "That's what the liquid morphine is used for," I told her. "These syringes will always be at your bedside and next to your recliner in case you need them." I showed her one of the 1 milliliter syringes that held just under a quarter of a teaspoon when filled to the brim. "You've been telling us that the morphine helps you breathe easier." "Yes, I noticed that I won't huff and puff when I walk if I take one syringe beforehand." "Well, we'll just have to make sure we have a caregiver here with you when you're unable to give them to yourself," I said, opening Pandora's box again. I knew this was another opportunity to figure out who was going to be with her when she was dying. Helen said nothing. I went on. Who could administer the medication to make sure your breathing stays comfortable? Who do you think your end-of-life caregiver could be, Helen? I asked, hoping at last for the answer to this looming question. I think my neighbor Claire would come. She's wonderful. She'll be here for me, she said with conviction. Is it okay for me to call and check with Claire today? I asked, not wanting to let the long-awaited opportunity slip past. Yes, you can call her. Okay, great. Let's call her in a few minutes after we finish your assessment. Is there anything else you worry about when it comes to dying? She had a far-off look in her eyes as she thought about the question. After a minute, I smiled and said, Can I ask you, Helen, have you had a good life? Oh, my dear, I've had a tough life, she said, pushing out all the air her worn-out lungs could offer. I felt the pain of it and effort of it like a knife. My heart sank. Though I had asked for it, this truth was not what I had expected. Wanting to honor the privilege of the moment with such a private woman, I leaned toward her to listen. My parents abused me when I was a child. When they were old, frail, and dying, I cared for both of them. Her shoulders sagged as the words came out. I understood the daunting task it must have been for her, physically and emotionally. That was an amazing gift to give to them in light of what they gave to you, I said, hoping to extend compassion and possibly a tiny bit of healing by validating Helen's selfless sacrifice. Well, my husband and I agreed it was the right thing to do. I'm still glad I did it. Somehow it felt good at the time. But honestly, now I'm afraid to see them again, Helen said, looking down at her lap as if confessing a sin. It was so unsettling for me to think of this petite, fragile woman still suffering from their abuse after her parents were dead and fearing they could abuse her again in the afterlife. How horrible! I knew the best answer was inside her own precious heart and soul. Do you mean you're afraid to see your parents again in heaven? I asked, hoping to clarify her fears. Yes, in heaven. My dad hurt me and messed with my mind. I was so afraid of him, I don't ever want to see him again. I could see the fear in her eyes like a scared child. This angst was not something I had seen before in this seemingly fearless woman. Helen, you've told me how strongly you believe in God and how you look forward to going to heaven to be with your husband. Do you believe that God would let your father hurt you again in heaven? She was silent for a minute, looking uneasy. I had to resist the urge to scoop her up and hug her as if she had been a lost child. She broke the silence. No, I don't think God would ever let anyone hurt me again. Relieved to hear this response, I said, well, maybe that's part of what's holding you back. I let the thought settle in. She was quiet and did not disagree. I reached for her hand, leaned in closer, and gazed into her fear-filled eyes. May I make a suggestion? Sure, dear. I'd love to hear it, Helen said, worn out by the dredged-up fear running through her head in our brief but intense conversation. I let my intuition speak, not knowing where the thought would lead me. Helen, pack up all the good memories of your lifetime, the good memories of your husband, who you said was the most wonderful man in the world and made you feel special. I squeezed her hand to offer support to her and push back my tears. She nodded and looked at me with watery eyes and a touch of curiousness. I like the sound of that. I like that very much, she said, with the fear no longer visible in her eyes. Her feeble body sat more upright. She grew in strength. You're right. I don't need those bad memories anymore. They're over and done, the feisty woman said as she pounded her fist on the table, her spirit emerging right before my eyes. My husband was such a great man. I miss him so much, and I can't wait to be with him again. Thank you, Ellie. I will pack my good memories. Oh, could you use a hug? Absolutely, my dear. I helped Helen stand up next to the kitchen table. She reached her arms around my waist and gave me a big squeeze. I would have responded with a big squeeze in return if not for fear of hurting her frail frame. So instead, I gently held on and let her determine the force and length of the hug. As quickly as the conversation started, it ended. When she finally let go, she said, "I'm going to sit down in my recliner and take off my oxygen so I can have a smoke." "Okay," I said, not surprised by her need to move on from the emotional conversation. I knew trying to stop Helen from smoking was a useless exercise. I set to work gathering up the syringes that were next to her recliner and on the small table by her bed, pre-filling them with liquid morphine. Once the vital task was complete, I sat on the couch next to her recliner and began my nursing documentation. Just as I had finished and her cigarette was out, she put her oxygen back on. There came a knock at the door. "Come in," Helen said in a raspy voice. Her neighbor Claire entered with a cheerful hello and a smile that lit up the room. I had met her once before and enjoyed her positive energy. "Hello, my dear," Helen said. "So good to see you." "Ellie and I have been having a great talk." I was surprised by her description of our discussion. "Oh, is that right? About what?" the neighbor asked. "You tell her," Helen motioned to me with an arthritic finger. My privilege, I thought, not just to tell Claire, but to have been trusted in the first place to have such an intimate conversation. "Well, today while we were talking, Helen said she was confused about why God hasn't come to take her yet." The neighbor nodded, and with eyebrows raised, shot me a look. Apparently, she had heard this too. I suggested that maybe she needed to pack her bags.
"Pack her bags?"
"Yes," I smiled at her perplexed look. I meant it metaphorically. I suggested she pack up only her good memories to take to heaven with her and leave any sad memories behind.
"Oh, that's lovely," Claire said, glancing at Helen, who was smiling and nodding in agreement.
"Thank you, but I can't take credit for it. It came to me as we were talking. I guess God was guiding me to help Helen with this dilemma today." I winked at them. We all laughed, and a sweet peace washed over the room. I had felt this before with some of my other patients and loved the deepness of it. I trusted that something greater than myself, greater than all of us, was at work. We also talked about who could care for her and stay with her as she becomes weaker and needs more help. I waited, holding my breath, hoping for Helen's wish to come true. The beautiful friend didn't hesitate. "I've been checking on her often for a few days now. I come over once during the night and every morning, afternoon, and evening, and I don't mind staying here on the couch if I need to." Oh, I was relieved to learn this and couldn't wait to leave a message on the nurse's line for the team to hear. Another divine intervention, I thought to myself. "You're such a great neighbor and friend, Claire," Helen said to her angel friend. "That's wonderful. Can I review the comfort medications with you? Do you have a minute now?" I asked, wanting to ensure Claire felt prepared for the physical changes that would arise in the coming days. "I do have time, yes." I headed toward the fridge to retrieve the comfort kit so we could review it together. Claire met me at the kitchen table. There were medications for fever, nausea and vomiting, anxiety, pain, shortness of breath, and a symptom referred to as terminal secretions.
I prepared Claire for the breathing changes and phlegm that might accumulate in Helen's airway, explaining that both were expected changes at the end of life. I removed the blue booklet from the hospice folder, a 14-page, well-written description of the physical signs I had described, so caregivers knew what to expect. Claire saw me pull it out. I already read through it a few weeks ago when the social worker visited. I found it interesting and helpful, she said. Do you have any questions about anything you read? No, but I've noticed many of the changes mentioned in the booklet. Is that good? Helen asked. Oh, yes, it means you're well on your way, Helen, I said, praising her efforts. Claire nodded in agreement. I, too, had noticed many of the changes and could easily understand why Helen wondered why she was still here. But I also realized she would die when she was truly ready to die. I had seen fear hold many patients back, so I felt an incredible sense of relief for Helen. We had discovered the fear that held her back, how to overcome it, and found someone to care for her when she was dying. It seemed like we had hit the trifecta. A few days later, no heavy burdens to hold her here, Helen got her long-awaited wish. It was in the early morning hours, and I was covering the overnight on-call shift. Her dear friend Claire informed me that Helen was gone. She said that she was so thankful she had spent the night. Oh, I'm glad you were there, too. Are you okay? I asked. Oh, I'm fine. What happens next? I can be there in about 20 minutes, and then after I pronounce her, I'll contact a funeral home for you. Okay, I'll see you soon. Thank you. And she was gone. The phone buzzed in my ear. I felt privileged that I would be the one to perform the pronouncement. When I arrived, Claire greeted me at the door with a hug. Then with that beautiful smile, she shared this story. The last thing she said last night after I got her settled into bed was that she wanted me to help her pack. I told her I felt honored, remembering your conversation and the symbolism. She said all she needed to take with her were her good memories and thanked me for being her friend and helping her. We never really packed anything physically, of course. I simply listened and she recounted stories of the happy times and the love she and her husband had shared. Then she drifted off to sleep. I slept on the couch so I could be close. I got up a few times during the night to medicate her for rapid breathing. Soon afterward, she was pretty peaceful, so I went back to lie down on the couch to rest again. It was hard to sleep because I kept listening to her breathing and that quiet rumbling in her throat. The medicine helped with the phlegm after a few doses, and then the rumbling stopped. I think it was after that when I finally did fall back to sleep. I checked on her early in the morning. When I entered the bedroom, I noticed she was still, and I didn't hear her breathing. That's when I realized that she had gone peacefully in her sleep. Oh, I'm so proud of Helen and happy that she's at peace. She did such a great job of facing her fears. Thank you, Claire. What a wonderful gift you gave to her by being here. She was able to die peacefully with a dear friend near and in the comfort of her own home. And thanks for helping her pack only her good memories, I said with a smile, still amazed that those words had come to me. Oh, I was happy to be here with her. I loved her like a mother. Oh, that's nice of you. You know, I like to tell caregivers that their generous gift of caregiving will ultimately come back to them again and again in their own lives. Knowing Helen as I did and remembering her will both be lasting gifts for me, she said. Together, we washed Helen's body and dressed her in a pretty outfit. She looked as lovely as ever, even in death. After the funeral director left with Helen, Claire and I hugged and said our goodbyes. As I drove away in the quiet of the early morning hour, I thought again about my words. The suggestion that came to me intuitively about packing the good memories. I thought about the fact that I had never heard or said those words before to anyone. They seemed so incredibly fitting at the moment. Actually, they seemed appropriate for many of the dying people I had already met. Could it be that the message is fitting for all of us? Since then, I've suggested packing good memories many times over. Patients who were struggling to lay distressing memories to rest reported that the symbolism helped them move forward. I was grateful I had listened to my intuition and was able to share the profound but simple message in a way that helped others. I was moved by the words that had come to me, so a few days after Helen died, I decided to meditate on them. I came away with this. When we embark on dying, we should gather all of the love and kindness granted to us during our lifetime, no matter how big or small, and pack it into our soul as sustenance in preparation for our journey. All of the pain, hardship, and suffering we endured can now be laid to rest. Their lessons no longer necessary. These lessons are the stumbling blocks of life, the challenges we've encountered. At the end of life, their presence no longer serves us. At life's end, it's best to allow the heavy burdens to fall away from our path and let our joyful spirit guide us forward. So that's Helen's story. I loved that I had only been a hospice nurse for a couple of months when I met Helen, and she taught me that great lesson about forgiveness. The message that came to me about packing only your good memories, like I said in the story, I had never heard that, read that, thought of that before in my life. It just came to me and seemed to be fitting in that moment for what was happening to her. And what really amazed me is that it seemed to be the thing that helped her let go of the fear of seeing her parents again. It may seem silly to some people that she was fearful that they would treat her the same way in the afterlife, but I can tell you that was not an uncommon concern. Over the coming years, as I met more and more people and got into more discussions about different things that they were fearful of or what was holding them back, this came up time and time again. So this is why reaching in deeply and discovering what it is that makes us react in certain ways or fear certain things is really important. I'm committed to it. I've been on this path of forgiveness for a long time. It is work. It's a constant work because no one's perfect. You know, you're always doing things that you wish you hadn't, or you say something and then immediately you think, oh my God, I wish I didn't say that. You can't go back. We've got to learn how to forgive ourselves, learn in the moment, and just try to do better the next time. We're human. We're going to make mistakes. We're not here to be perfect. And also, I really believe that most of the things that happen, even when they're hurtful, are not intentional. But the more aware you become, you realize everyone's suffering, and the things that they're doing and saying have usually nothing to do with you. That's why you'll hear me recommend this book countless times. The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz is a great book that will help you understand about not taking things personally, not making assumptions about why someone talked to you in a certain tone or a certain way. It's all about just being present in the moment and dealing with where you are and trying to put your best self forward. And truly, being kind to yourself first so that you can go forward in a loving way. Because when we've got this constant criticism in the back of our heads for ourselves, we don't show up in kind ways and happy ways. It's almost like we're purposefully sabotaging because we don't feel good about ourselves. It is complicated. So let's keep on this discussion. It's important. And I think the more we talk about it and people can relate to different stories from guests on the podcast, it will help us uncover how to be kinder to ourselves, how to forgive ourselves and forgive others, and how to focus more on the good things that are happening in our lives so we can have more joy and happiness. I'm thankful for this story,
because it offered me a wonderful lesson that I will always be grateful and thankful to Helen for teaching me. Okay, that's it for episode 8. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in next week. And remember, life offers endless possibilities. We simply need to be open to them. Here's to a good life and a good death. Have a great week.